Going to read from John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 1 to 18. And that's on page 1068 of the Bibles that are on your chairs. It's page 1068, John 1, starting at verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. He came as a witness, to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God, who is at the Father's side, has made him known."
Bex, thank you very much. I add my welcome to Nigel's. It's very good to see you. And if you've joined us for the first time this evening, an especially warm welcome to you. The issue I want us to look at together this evening is the issue of knowing God. And we're going to look at just one verse, which is the summary of probably the most famous reading in the New Testament that we just had read to us, and it's there in verse 18. So if you could keep your Bible open on page 1068, you can see it there, John chapter 1, verse 18. "No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." So there's our verse, and there is the issue of knowing God. Obviously, it's a good place to start on a week like this, a week of talks looking at the Christian faith. Our claim as Christians is that Jesus has come to give us life, life connected to God today, and life with God in heaven forever. And the obvious place to start in any sort of week like this is, how can we know anything about God? How can we know God ourselves with any degree of certainty? And what I'm going to call the spirituality of our age makes this a really important issue for us, and I think makes it quite a contentious verse, as we'll see in just a few moments' time. For in spite of the huge changes that there have been over the last 50 years or so, it seems that our age remains as spiritual an age as any. I just finished reading a book by a sociologist called Gracie Davey, who's done a good deal of research over the last few decades. And she suggests that following the 1960s, which was a period of loss of interest in the sacred, between the 1970s and through to the 80s, there was what she calls a period of the re-emergence of the sacred, and into the 90s, a new kind of definition of the sacred, such that people today, and her statistics bear it out, are as spiritually interested and spiritually aware as they have ever been, though the forms of spirituality have changed. There was an article in the Financial Times just around Christmas time entitled "Now I'm a Believer," in which the author made the observation that, quote, "it is no longer fashionable not to believe. And the article said this: atheism has gone the way of arguing in favour of nuclear disarmament, a sort of passé 60s fad. Quote, for many Westerners, it has become the norm to master Buddhist chanting in a meditation class, learn about ancient Hindu philosophies during a yoga class, light a candle and say a prayer to a nameless god back at home. Well, now that may not be quite you, but you get the sort of idea, and I think we can see it emerging all around us in our culture, that we are as spiritual an age as any. If you come across the Eastern idea of feng shui, spelt feng shui, where you arrange your furniture and architecture in order to ensure positive energy forces around your office or your home. In fact, the office just immediately on your left as you go out there, Robert Hiscox's office, is organized entirely around the feng shui principle. There is a water feature to avoid negative forces coming from the CGNU building here, if you work in the CGNU building. There is a water tank, which I find rather offensive, with fish in it to avoid negative powers coming from here, our church. And actually, Robert Hiscox very kindly asked me to lunch the other day and asked me what I thought of it. The very first sentence says we sat at this boardroom surrounded by his minions. And I said that I happen to know that feng shui, you're supposed to have 7 fish in one side and 7 on the other. And at last count, I'd seen they'd been breeding on one side, disease on the other. And the score was 13-4. I popped out just now, actually. I think the score is now 9-6. So there may have been a fish hiding somewhere. Anyway, we may giggle at it, but spirituality is, well, almost trendy today. Next time you pick up someone else's copy of Hello Magazine, notice how spirituality is almost a fashion. Britney Spears, Madonna, Demi Moore, Stella McCartney, crystals, Kabbalah, yoga, saints, icons. Indeed, around here in the city, the management manuals and the human resources handbooks and the personnel publications are beginning to suggest that these days a firm needs to have some sort of spiritual awareness, outlet, program, if they are going to get the best out of their staff. And therefore, this reemergence of a fascination with the spiritual makes this evening's issue all the more important. How can we know God? How can we know anything about God? How can we be sure about what we know about God? And I want to spend the evening just looking at the two assertions there in John 1:18. One negative, a lesson about us, what I'm going to call the universal condition of humanity, the universal condition, sorry, I haven't been on the sherbets, the universal condition of humanity, and secondly, a lesson about God, what I'm going to call the unmatched claim of Christianity. So first, a lesson about us, the universal condition of humanity. This is a lesson about you and me, and you can see it there in verse 18, no one has ever seen God. Now that is, I think, a clear statement of fact that we would all agree with. I don't think it's particularly objectionable or offensive in and of itself. I'm not going to do it, but were we to conduct a survey right here and now, it's not the sort of thing we do in St. Helens, so rest assured, we're not going to ask you to do it, and ask you to put your hand up if, listen to this carefully, if you have met God face to face in a visual, fully cognitive, personal encounter. Put your hand up. No, it didn't surprise me at all. I don't think there's anybody anywhere in any time, at any age, who in their right mind has claimed to have had a face-to-face, fully cognitive, personal encounter with the living God. So it's not actually, on the face of it, a particularly confrontational remark. But it's repeated over and over again in John's Gospel. John has this wonderful way of defining what he's saying by stating the negative. And so he says, chapter 5, verse 37, Jesus says, you have never heard God's voice or seen his form. Chapter 6, verse 46, Jesus says, "No one has seen the Father." Chapter 8, verse 19, "You neither know me nor my Father." In and of itself, not a particularly confrontational remark. But, of course, this universal condition means that your ideas and my ideas about what God might be like are at best guesswork. Has to be the case, doesn't it? However sophisticated, however plausible, however popular our ideas may sound, at the end of the day, if you have not seen God, and I have not seen God face to face, and nobody else has seen God face to face, then our ideas about God are mere speculation at best, at worst, simply wrong, misleading, and misguided. Why, to put it in the language of Jesus in John chapter 8, we are in the dark. And of course, if we're in the dark about God, merely left grasping speculatively after truth about God, why, we may recognize that a divine being is there through the creation. We may have a sense of divine justice and moral order through our conscience. We may desire to reach out and make contact with some greater force. But at the end of the day, we can't have any kind of meaningful relationship with him or her because we've never seen him, her, or it. And our best effort at guessing what he or she is like is pure speculation. Well, not many of us, but I guess some of us here this evening have been at some stage in the position of expecting a baby. If you haven't, then no doubt you can remember, you know, a brother or a sister or a nephew or a niece or something like that. And you know, or I'm told you know, because something seems to tell you that the child is there. And you have a kind of growing conviction that there really is life. And you even see those sort of fuzzy pictures that bear a striking resemblance to the underwater photos of the Loch Ness Monster. But as far as really knowing what this creature is like or what they're going to be like, why, you're as much in the dark as I am. You don't know what colour its eyes will be. You don't know what kind of character it may have. You don't know what it will like or dislike. You're clueless. Will it be gentle and kind, glamorous and loving, like its mother? Or rumbustious and aggressive, harsh, big-nosed and opinionated, like its grandmother? You see, all of those guesses, they're just guesses. Speculation. You haven't got a clue. Now, it's a trivial illustration, isn't it? But when it comes to God, and when it comes to spiritual affairs, it really does matter if we're in the dark. It really matters, because the stakes are so high. When it comes to life and death and heaven and hell, if we are ignorant and our thinking is futile, it really matters. A little while ago, I was on a train up to Chesterfield. It's some while ago now, and there was a father with three small children sitting at the same table as me. The train was full, and so I couldn't move. And actually, the children were beautifully behaved. There was a girl called Anna on her mobile, engaged in a high decibel conversation with her fiancé, who caused the greatest pain. If anybody wants to know where Anna and her fiancé were going on their honeymoon, what they were planning to do when they got there, and anything other detail of the couple, I'm very happy to let you know. In fact, when we finally got, she got off the train at, I think it was Leicester, one businessman sitting near me said loudly to the rest of the carriage, "I have never been so glad to get to Leicester in all my life." I was tempted to ring the fiancé myself and warn him to bail out while the going was good. But anyway, Anna is a complete aside and not relevant at all to what we're talking about. Let's get back to the children their grandfather had obviously died a couple of months earlier. And, you know, it was one of those enormously poignant scenes as the eldest child kept asking his father what had happened to Grandpa. You know, one of those conversations that all of us face at some stage of our life. Somehow on the lips of a six-year-old, it's all the more poignant. And eventually the grieving father replied, "Grandpa has gone to sleep." The whole family reached a happy understanding of what had happened. And I wanted to say, but I didn't have the courage, and it would have been utterly inappropriate, but I wanted to say, how do you know? We place a bunch of flowers on the grave of a loved one or a celebrity. Thousands did it, didn't they, at Diana's death. Or remember Hillsborough, "You'll never walk alone." Or Walt Disney in The Lion King, "Oh, they've gone to be a glittering star up there somewhere." And the message reads, "Sleep well." But how do we know? Well, we've never seen God. We don't know what he's like. We can't say with certainty. We're in the dark. How do you know that they're sleeping well? We offer up a prayer at a time of intense personal need, a job loss, stress in a relationship, a time of illness or pain. But if no one has ever seen God, well, how do we know he's even listening? How do we know if he wants to answer the prayer? If we're in the dark, we're clueless. We object on moral grounds to the fact that there might be corruption in our government or to some military situation or another. But at the end of the day, if you haven't seen God, how do you know what is right and what is not right? You see, what John does in this very simple few words, "No one has ever seen God," is he confronts us with the universal condition of humanity. We are ignorant on our own. We have no understanding on our own. On our own, because we haven't seen God, our thinking can only be futile and foolish. All we can do is construct an idol of our own making in our own image. And in a culture where it is trendy to be spiritual, we need to be really clear on that point. So let me ask you, quite straight up front, do you realize that, well, if you've not seen God, well, then you are quite simply in the dark? First, a lesson about us, the universal condition of humanity. Secondly, a lesson about God, the unmatched claim of Christianity. And there, back at our verse, just glance down at it again, would you? Chapter 1, verse 18, "No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." Now, the only God there is referring to Jesus Christ. You can see that there are two people being spoken about, the Father and the only God who's at the Father's side. It is a statement about the identity of Jesus. He is the only God, says John. He is fully divine. The word is used to refer to a greatly loved one, a one and only child. And he's speaking about the character described in chapter 1, verse 1. "In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God." And then chapter 1, further down, "The Word became flesh." The word "at the Father's side" in verse 18 speaks of the place of greatest intimacy and relationship and knowledge. The old translation has "who is in the bosom of the Father." And the point John is making is that this Jesus Christ is uniquely qualified to make God known to us, for he has been always at the Father's side. Look at our verse, "who is at the Father's side." For he has always been at the Father's side. He is fully divine, and therefore he is uniquely qualified to make God known to us. and the word made known is a word which literally translated reads led out. It means to declare or to narrate or to explain or to make known. The tense is a past tense, isn't it? He has made him known. So how about this? This is one of the theological boffins. He's translated the verse like this. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only who is at the Father's side has declared him once and forever. Do you see the unmatched claim of Jesus Christ? Let's be clear about this. No one else, nowhere else, in their right mind, has ever made a claim like this that has been received and passed on in all seriousness as authentic historical fact. No one. Later in the Gospel, Jesus says, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Elsewhere in the Gospel, Jesus says, I and the Father are one. The one and only who is at the Father's side, he has declared him once and forever. So here is the claim. Look at the works of Jesus Christ. He turns water into wine. He heals a dying child. He makes a cripple walk. He heals a man born blind. He raises a dead man who's begun to rot. He is raised himself from the dead. Look at the works of Jesus Christ and you see the work of God. Listen to the words of Jesus. The crowds hear him and say, we've never heard anybody teach like this ever before. This teaching is amazing. The teaching has shaped the history of the world through the centuries. Listen to the words of Jesus and you will hear the words of God himself. Study the character of Jesus, the beautiful, perfect character. His disciples said he never said or did anything wrong. He related to the rich, he related to the poor, he related to the child, he related to the adult, he related to the intellectual, he related to the less intellectual. Study the character of Jesus Christ and you will find the character of God. Discover the priorities of Jesus and you will understand the future. Come to know Jesus Christ personally and you will come to know God himself personally. Do you notice again what John is not saying in this verse? John is not saying that Jesus is a wonderful prophet who went up to a cave on a mountain where God gave him a number of disconnected statements about himself. He is saying Jesus is God himself. John is not saying that Jesus is an inspired holy man who can tell you a wise thing or two about God. And John is not saying that Jesus is a great thinker, a magnificent theologian who's come up with some brilliant ideas about God. He is saying that Jesus Christ is God himself. And the aim of this week is for us to look at that claim and to examine it. For if we come then to know Jesus Christ, we have come to know God personally. The darkness is banished. We are no longer clueless. We are in the light. And we know God with certainty. The unmatched claim of Jesus Christ. And as such, this does tell us the most glorious truth about God, doesn't it? I'm one of 11 cousins. And as a small child, we often used to descend on my grandparents for a week of the year up in North Norfolk. As you can imagine, we all thought it was the best and most exciting week of the year. We used to long for it. For my grandparents and their neighbours, I can only imagine that the 24 weeks leading up to our visit was spent psyching up, and the 25 weeks following our visit were spent in therapy. One of the games we used to play when we were there was that good old family favourite, you know it, Blind Man's Bluff. It's a great game when there are 21 of you all together, one child with the blindfold on, our kids have just started playing it actually now, with all the grown-ups and the children, 21 of us, or 20 of us, tiptoeing around the room, occasionally emerging from behind the sofa or under a table to prod the blind searcher, and then dashing off again, giggling intensely. You played it? You're looking blank. Oh, well, never mind. We're not going to play it tonight. But it's a great game. It is a great game. But it is only a game, and it's only fun because it's a game. You know, when it comes to the real issues of life and death, of heaven and of hell, of existence and eternity, you know, it's not fun to play the game of life and eternity with the blindfold on. So some people like to speculate about God, don't they? And in their guesswork, they make God out to be a kind of mysterious, distant, mythical force who can never really be known. And they try to convince us that God is sort of hidden away, and that we have to jump through mystical hoops or climb over institutional hurdles or endlessly run around the circle of life if we're going to find God. Think about it for a moment. What kind of ghastly idol would God be if he deliberately hid himself away with his arms folded over his fat belly, smiling down at the world and all its difficulties? What kind of obscene deity plays hide and seek with his creatures when the stakes are so high? Do you see what John is saying? God is not playing hide and seek with us. He has stepped down from heaven in the person of Jesus Christ. He has made himself known once for all, declared himself, and we can step out of the dark into the light and know him with certainty. Well, there then is the unmatched claim of Jesus. It speaks of the grace and mercy of God, the kindness and goodness of God, the love of God, the fact that he wants you to know him. And let me say, if you're here as a visitor, it's great that you've come along this evening. God does not want you to face the key issues of life and death with a blindfold on. And he is offering every one of us the opportunity to step out into the light, to live life connected to God and certain of eternity. Let me encourage you to come on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday evening. We'd love to see you here. There's plenty of room. Come and discover the person of Jesus Christ as we look at his life. Or Christianity Explored is another great way, and I'll say something about that later on. For now, I think we're going to break. Are we going to sing first, Nigel? We're going to sing, and then we'll break. And you may have questions, and if you've got a question, it would help me enormously if you could write your question out immediately following the song we're now going to sing, because then I'll have a chance to have a think about it and try and answer it.
Going to read from John's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 1 to 18, and that's on page 1068 of the Bibles that are on your chairs. It's page 1068, John 1, starting at verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness, to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.'" And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God, who is at the Father's side, has made him known.
Bex, thank you very much. May I add my welcome to Nigel's? It's very good to see you. And if you've joined us for the first time this evening, an especially warm welcome to you. The issue I want us to look at together this evening is the issue of knowing God. And we're going to look at just one verse, which is the summary of probably the most famous reading in the New Testament that we just had read to us. And it's there in verse 18. So if you could keep your Bible open on page 1068, you can see it there. John chapter 1, verse 18. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. So there's our verse, and there is the issue of knowing God. Obviously, it's a good place to start on a week like this, a week of talks looking at the Christian faith. Our claim as Christians is that Jesus has come to give us life, life connected to God today, and life with God in heaven forever. And the obvious place to start in any sort of week like this is, how can we know anything about God? How can we know God ourselves with any degree of certainty? And what I'm going to call the spirituality of our age makes this a really important issue for us, and I think makes it quite a contentious verse, as we'll see in just a few moments' time. For in spite of the huge changes that there have been over the last 50 years or so, it seems that our age remains as spiritual an age as any. I just finished reading a book by a sociologist called Gracie Davey, who's done a good deal of research over the last few decades. And she suggests that following the 1960s, which was a period of loss of interest in the sacred, between the 1970s and through to the 80s, there was what she calls a period of the re-emergence of the sacred, and into the 90s, a new kind of definition of the sacred, such that people today, and her statistics bear it out, are as spiritually interested and spiritually aware as they have ever been, though the forms of spirituality have changed. There was an article in the Financial Times just around Christmas time entitled "Now I'm a Believer," in which the author made the observation that, quote, "it is no longer fashionable not to believe." And the article said this: "Atheism has gone the way of arguing in favor of nuclear disarmament, a sort of passé 60s fad. Quote, for many Westerners, it has become the norm to master Buddhist chanting in a meditation class, learn about ancient Hindu philosophies during a yoga class, light a candle and say a prayer to a nameless god back at home." Well, now that may not be quite you, but you get the sort of idea, and I think we can see it emerging all around us in our culture, that we are as spiritual an age as any. If you come across the Eastern idea of feng shui, spelt feng shui, where you arrange your furniture and architecture in order to ensure positive energy forces around your office or your home. In fact, the office just immediately on your left as you go out there, Robert Hiscox's office, is organized entirely around the feng shui principle. There is a water feature to avoid negative forces coming from the CGNU building here, if you work in the CGNU building. There is a water tank, which I find rather offensive, with fish in it to avoid negative powers coming from here, our church. And actually, Robert Hiscox very kindly asked me to lunch the other day and asked me what I thought of it. The very first sentence says, we sat at this boardroom surrounded by his minions, and I said that I happened to know that feng shui, you're supposed to have 7 fish in one side and 7 on the other, and at last count I'd seen they'd been breeding on one side, disease on the other, and the score was 13-4. I popped out just now, actually. I think the score is now 9-6, so there may have been a fish hiding somewhere. Anyway, we may giggle at it, but spirituality is, well, almost trendy today. Next time you pick up someone else's copy of Hello Magazine, notice how spirituality is almost a fashion. Britney Spears, Madonna, Demi Moore, Stella McCartney, crystals, Kabbalah, yoga, saints, icons. Indeed, around here in the city, the management manuals and the human resources handbooks and the personnel publications are beginning to suggest that these days a firm needs to have some sort of spiritual awareness, outlet, program, if they are going to get the best out of their staff. And therefore, this reemergence of a fascination with the spiritual makes this evening's issue all the more important. How can we know God? How can we know anything about God? How can we be sure about what we know about God? And I want to spend the evening just looking at the two assertions there in John 1:18. One negative, a lesson about us, what I'm going to call the universal condition of humanity, the universal condition, sorry, I haven't been on the sherbets, the universal condition of humanity, and secondly, a lesson about God, what I'm going to call the unmatched claim of Christianity. So first, a lesson about us, the universal condition of humanity. This is a lesson about you and me, and you can see it there in verse 18, no one has ever seen God. Now that is, I think, a clear statement of fact that we would all agree with. I don't think it's particularly objectionable or offensive in and of itself. I'm not going to do it, but were we to conduct a survey right here and now, it's not the sort of thing we do in St. Helens, so rest assured, we're not going to ask you to do it, and ask you to put your hand up if, listen to this carefully, if you have met God face to face in a visual, fully cognitive, personal encounter. Put your hand up. No, it didn't surprise me at all. I don't think there's anybody anywhere in any time, at any age, who in their right mind has claimed to have had a face-to-face, fully cognitive, personal encounter with the living God. So it's not actually, on the face of it, a particularly confrontational remark. But it's repeated over and over again in John's Gospel. John has this wonderful way of defining what he's saying by stating the negative. And so he says, chapter 5, verse 37, Jesus says, you have never heard God's voice or seen his form. Chapter 6, verse 46, Jesus says, no one has seen the Father. Chapter 8, verse 19, you neither know me nor my Father. In and of itself, not a particularly confrontational remark. But, of course, this universal condition means that your ideas and my ideas about what God might be like are at best guesswork. Has to be the case, doesn't it? However sophisticated, however plausible, however popular our ideas may sound, at the end of the day, if you have not seen God, and I have not seen God face to face, and nobody else has seen God face to face, then our ideas about God are mere speculation, at best, at worst, simply wrong, misleading, and misguided. Right, to put it in the language of Jesus, in John chapter 8, we are in the dark. And of course, if we're in the dark about God, merely left grasping speculatively after truth about God, why, we may recognize that a divine being is there through the creation. We may have a sense of divine justice and moral order through our conscience. We may desire to reach out and make contact with some greater force. But at the end of the day, we can't have any kind of meaningful relationship with him or her because we've never seen him, her, or it. And our best effort at guessing what he or she is like is pure speculation. Well, not many of us, but I guess some of us here this evening have been at some stage in the position of expecting a baby. If you haven't, then no doubt you can remember, you know, a brother or a sister or a nephew or a niece or something like that. And you know, or I'm told you know, because something seems to tell you that the child is there. And you have a kind of growing conviction that there really is life. And you even see those sort of fuzzy pictures that bear a striking resemblance to the underwater photos of the Loch Ness Monster. But as far as really knowing what this creature is like or what they're going to be like, why, you're as much in the dark as I am. You don't know what colour its eyes will be. You don't know what kind of character it may have. You don't know what it will like or dislike. You're clueless. Will it be gentle and kind, glamorous and loving, like its mother? Or rumbustious and aggressive, harsh, big-nosed and opinionated, like its grandmother? You see, All of those guesses, they're just guesses. Speculation. You haven't got a clue. And it's a trivial illustration, isn't it? But when it comes to God, and when it comes to spiritual affairs, it really does matter if we're in the dark. It really matters, because the stakes are so high. When it comes to life and death and heaven and hell, if we are ignorant and our thinking is futile, it really matters. A little while ago, I was on a train up to Chesterfield. It's some while ago now, and there was a father with three small children sitting at the same table as me. The train was full, and so I couldn't move. And actually, the children were beautifully behaved. There was a girl called Anna on her mobile engaged in a high decibel conversation with her fiancé who caused the greatest pain. If anybody wants to know where Anna and her fiancé were going on their honeymoon, what they were planning to do when they got there, and anything other detail of the couple, I'm very happy to let you know. In fact, when we finally got, she got off the train at, I think it was Leicester, one businessman sitting near me said loudly to the rest of the carriage, "I have never been so glad to get to Leicester in all my life." I was tempted to ring the fiancé myself and warn him to bail out while the going was good. But anyway, Anna is a complete aside and not relevant at all to what we're talking about. Let's get back to the children. Their grandfather had obviously died a couple of months earlier. And, you know, it was one of those enormously poignant scenes as the eldest child kept asking his father what had happened to Grandpa. You know, one of those conversations that all of us face at some stage of our life. Somehow on the lips of a six-year-old, it's all the more poignant. And eventually the grieving father replied, "Grandpa has gone to sleep." The whole family reached a happy understanding of what had happened. And I wanted to say, but I didn't have the courage, and it would have been utterly inappropriate, but I wanted to say, how do you know? We place a bunch of flowers on the grave of a loved one or a celebrity. Thousands did it, didn't they, at Diana's death. Or remember Hillsborough, "You'll never walk alone." Or Walt Disney in The Lion King, "Oh, they've gone to be a glittering star up there somewhere." And the message reads, sleep well. But how do we know? Well, we've never seen God. We don't know what he's like. We can't say with certainty. We're in the dark. How do you know that they're sleeping well? We offer up a prayer at a time of intense personal need, a job loss, stress in a relationship, a time of illness or pain. But if no one has ever seen God, well, how do we know he's even listening? How do we know if he wants to answer the prayer? If we're in the dark, we're clueless. We object on moral grounds to the fact that there might be corruption in our government or to some military situation or another. But at the end of the day, if you haven't seen God, how do you know what is right and what is not right? You see, what John does in this very simple few words, "No one has ever seen God," is he confronts us with the universal condition of humanity. We are ignorant on our own. We have no understanding on our own. On our own, because we haven't seen God, our thinking can only be futile and foolish. All we can do is construct an idol of our own making in our own image. And in a culture where it is trendy to be spiritual, we need to be really clear on that point. So let me ask you quite straight up front. Do you realize that, well, if you've not seen God, well, then you are quite simply in the dark? First, a lesson about us, the universal condition of humanity. Secondly, a lesson about God, the unmatched claim of Christianity. And there, back at our verse, just glance down at it again, would you? Chapter 1, verse 18, "No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." Now, the only God there is referring to Jesus Christ. You can see that there are two people being spoken about, the Father and the only God who's at the Father's side. It is a statement about the identity of Jesus. He is the only God, says John. He is fully divine. The word is used to refer to a greatly loved one, a one and only child. And he's speaking about the character described in chapter 1, verse 1. "In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God." And then chapter 1, further down, "The Word became flesh." The word "at the Father's side" in verse 18 speaks of the place of greatest intimacy and relationship and knowledge. The old translation has "who is in the bosom of the Father." And the point John is making is that this Jesus Christ is uniquely qualified to make God known to us, for he has been always at the Father's side. Look at our verse, "who is at the Father's side." For he has always been at the Father's side. He is fully divine, and therefore he is uniquely qualified to make God known to us. And the word "made known" is a word which literally translated reads "led out." It means to declare or to narrate or to explain or to make known. The tense is a past tense, isn't it? He has made him known. So how about this? This is one of the theological boffins. He's translated the verse like this: "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only who is at the Father's side has declared him once and forever." Do you see the unmatched claim of Jesus Christ? Let's be clear about this. No one else, nowhere else in their right mind has ever made a claim like this that has been received and passed on in all seriousness as authentic historical fact. No one. Later in the Gospel, Jesus says, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Elsewhere in the Gospel, Jesus says, I and the Father are one. The one and only who is at the Father's side, he has declared him once and forever. So here is the claim. Look at the works of Jesus Christ. He turns water into wine. He heals a dying child. He makes a cripple walk. He heals a man born blind. He raises a dead man who's begun to rot. He is raised himself from the dead. Look at the works of Jesus Christ and you see the work of God. Listen to the words of Jesus. The crowds hear him and say, we've never heard anybody teach like this ever before. This teaching is amazing. The teaching has shaped the history of the world through the centuries. Listen to the words of Jesus and you will hear the words of God himself. Study the character of Jesus, the beautiful, perfect character. His disciples said he never said or did anything wrong. He related to the rich, he related to the poor, he related to the child, he related to the adult, he related to the intellectual, he related to the less intellectual. Study the character of Jesus Christ and you will find the character of God. Discover the priorities of Jesus and you will understand the future. Come to know Jesus Christ personally and you will come to know God himself personally. Do you notice again what John is not saying in this verse? John is not saying that Jesus is a wonderful prophet who went up to a cave on a mountain where God gave him a number of disconnected statements about himself. He is saying Jesus is God himself. John is not saying that Jesus is an inspired holy man who can tell you a wise thing or two about God. And John is not saying that Jesus is a great thinker, a magnificent theologian who's come up with some brilliant ideas about God. He is saying that Jesus Christ is God himself. And the aim of this week is for us to look at that claim and to examine it. For if we come then to know Jesus Christ, we have come to know God personally. The darkness is banished. We are no longer clueless. We are in the light. And we know God with certainty. The unmatched claim of Jesus Christ. And as such, this does tell us the most glorious truth about God, doesn't it? I'm one of 11 cousins. And as a small child, we often used to descend on my grandparents for a week of the year up in North Norfolk. As you can imagine, we all thought it was the best and most exciting week of the year. We used to long for it. For my grandparents and their neighbours, I can only imagine that the 24 weeks leading up to our visit was spent psyching up, and the 25 weeks following our visit were spent in therapy. One of the games we used to play when we were there was that good old family favourite, you know it, Blind Man's Bluff. It's a great game when there are 21 of you all together, one child with the blindfold on. Our kids have just started playing it actually now. With all the grown-ups and the children, 21 of us, or 20 of us, tiptoeing around the room, occasionally emerging from behind the sofa or under a table to prod the blind searcher, and then dashing off again, giggling intensely. You played it? You're looking blank. Oh, well, never mind. We're not going to play it tonight. But it's a great game. It is a great game. But it is only a game. And it's only fun because it's a game. You know, when it comes to the real issues of life and death, of heaven and of hell, of existence and eternity, it's not fun to play the game of life and eternity with the blindfold on. So some people like to speculate about God, don't they? And in their guesswork, they make God out to be a kind of mysterious, distant, mythical force who can never really be known. And they try to convince us that God is sort of hidden away and that we have to jump through mystical hoops or climb over institutional hurdles or endlessly run around the circle of life if we're going to find God. Think about it for a moment. What kind of ghastly idol would God be if he deliberately hid himself away with his arms folded over his fat belly, smiling down at the world and all its difficulties? What kind of obscene deity plays hide and seek with his creatures when the stakes are so high? Do you see what John is saying? God is not playing hide and seek with us. He has stepped down from heaven in the person of Jesus Christ. He has made himself known once for all, declared himself, and we can step out of the dark into the light and know him with certainty. Well, there then is the unmatched claim of Jesus. It speaks of the grace and mercy of God, the kindness and goodness of God, the love of God, the fact that he wants you to know him. And let me say, if you're here as a visitor, it's great that you've come along this evening. God does not want you to face the key issues of life and death with a blindfold on. And he is offering every one of us the opportunity to step out into the light, to live life connected to God and certain of eternity. Let me encourage you to come on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday evening. We'd love to see you here. There's plenty of room. Come and discover the person of Jesus Christ as we look at his life. Or Christianity Explored is another great way, and I'll say something about that later on. For now, I think we're going to break. Are we going to sing first, Nigel? We're going to sing, and then we'll break. And you may have questions, and if you've got a question, it would help me enormously if you could write your question out immediately following the song we're now going to sing, because then I'll have a chance to have a think about it and try and answer it.